Welcome to Making Data Matter, where we have conversations about data and leadership at mission-driven organizations with practical insights into the intersection of nonprofit mission, strategy, and data. I'm your host, Sawyer Nyquist.
I'm your co-host, Troy Duick.
And today we're joined by guest Philip Wallace. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. Thank you.
And for folks just meeting you for the first time, Philip, give us a little bit of background about who you are and what you do.
Well, for background, first off, I'm incredible and believe everything I say. No, I'm joking, but only halfway. No, I I serve as the Director of Knowledge Management at UNCF, that's the United Negro College Fund. Context about that. UNCF is an 80-year-old organization that was created to support private HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. I realize there are a lot of acronyms in my description. Now, my team is ICB, known as the Institute for Capacity Building. We're not focused on fundraising or student programs. We're focused on building capacity at a lot of HBCUs around the country. A lot of data show that HBCUs, when you look at various metrics, they have been punching above their weight when it comes to supporting black students in higher education. And many times, in other words, HBCUs have been doing more with less. Part of what the Institute for Capacity Building, part of what we focus on is how do we support HBCUs so that they can do more with more. My whole career has been in higher ed. Those is like 17, 18 years in higher ed and private university, public universities, and then now here with the nonprofit UNCF.
So already one of those words sticks out to me, capacity building. And that's not a phrase I've heard thrown around a lot. So give me a little more like context around what does it look like? How do you define capacity in the context of higher ed? And what does it look like to build capacity?
Yeah, that's a great question. Period. No, I mean, I say they have jokingly, but because the capacity is so broad and we are a fully grant funded organization. So there are certain things where we want to help build capacity, but if we're honest, there are certain levels of capacity that we can't really, you know, practically reach in it or build in a sustainable way. So for example, if you have an institution where, hey, look, they're understaffed by 15, 20 people. Okay, well, we're kind of limited there. We don't have infinite funds to do that. But in our specific context, we have a set of transformation partners, and we will look at various functions in the university and engage and say, what are your needs? Where are you right now, basically? Where are you trying to get to? What's the gap? You know, just doing a gap analysis. And then let's partner with you to say, how do we identify some solutions to get us from where we are to where we want to be, or at least somewhat closer there so we could be bridging that gap. And then from there, we have one of our verticals is primarily focused on providing that transformation support. My vertical is focused on really part of it is measuring the impact of and the progress of transformation efforts, but also partnering with HBCUs to help shape their data strategy, to cultivate data communities of data fluency, and to facilitate data maturity. There is another vertical that's focused on digital innovations and things of that nature. We have another one that's focused on engaging executive leaders and boards. Another one that's focused on strategic finance. So how do we partner? And we're trying to do things at scale because we could do more. We're trying to basically multiply our efforts instead of saying a one-on-one. But how do we focus along these areas to say what are some scalable, sustainable areas and opportunities to help bridge the gap from where you are to where you need to go from surviving to thriving.
All right. So that already probably spans a lot of different areas, even just thinking about the complexities of a university system and how do you impact change in different areas. So give me details around like what kind of data are you looking at? What sort of data are you managing and reviewing to measure progress and success? Is that student outcomes? Is that admissions? Is that like academic performance or financing of those programs? Give me some more ideas about that.
Yes, all of it, all of the above. Okay. Now, the issue is I'm the first director in this role. So that means we're at the beginning of our data collection and just our data strategy. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about, particularly UNCF works with we focus primarily on the private HBCUs. Okay. Okay. My team endeavors to work with all of them. However, I'm not sure if you know this, but so we'll talk about the public HBCUs. Many of them have been underfunded. They're supposed to be getting their land grant institutions. Land grant, you get a certain amount from federal dollars. Your state is supposed to match it. For decades, many of them, if not most of them, have been, I'll say most, if not all, rather, have been underfunded. The states have not been matching the land grants for the public HBCUs. However, they have been matching up the land grants for the non-HBCUs in those same states. So at the beginning, you see inequity, you see problems there. But to go further, the private HBCUs don't even get, they don't even qualify for the land grants. So there's even more. So that's the first part I want to say, like, just for context, not to set a context of a deficit, but just here's the reality. We could look at these systemic realities that impact their operation. I'm a Georgia Tech alumnus, and you can see the impact of continued investment in an institution over time. And so likewise, you can therefore see the impact of when institutions don't have that investment over time. How does that apply to data? Well, people want to get data. Everyone wants to have data, but then you say you have a team of maybe one or two people who are actually doing 3 to 5 jobs each. And we're saying, hey, can you get these data? It's not that simple. It's not that simple. Or, hey, here's these certain things we've been doing. Let's switch and let's pivot. It's not that simple. Just the very capacity to retrieve the data may be a concern. And so part of my perspective coming from higher ed, having worked at institutions, is to engage with the folks, the data practitioners and leaders, to say, hey, look, I get where you all are. I've been there, done it, albeit not at HBCUs, but I've done it in universities. And so let's understand where things are from your place, from your perspective, and how do we find ways that are mutually beneficial to get us to where we need to be. So we're at the beginning stages of just understanding a lot of these things. It's crazy how going from the data for decision-making, it very quickly takes you back into data governance and data quality. It takes you right back into the processes. And then pretty much now you're back into the politics and you're like, how am I even having this conversation when I thought we were just trying to, you know, build a dashboard. But a lot of these things are all tied together.
And I think that brings up a question about focus. Like, data is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. There's, you know, just in our own personal devices, there are thousands of data points that as we pull up our smartphones and we're going places, so much data. So how do you put on a grid or a decision matrix in knowing what data is important to the particular initiatives that you're going after? How do you get that strategic alignment with your senior leaders and saying, this is what we want to focus on in data? What's that process look like for you, Philip?
It's a bit of a mix because, as I said before, we're grant funded. So some of our funds, I mean, our grants rather, and the funders, they already have ideas of what they'd like to see. And so, bam, that's kind of there. What I try to do in those conversations is when I see that the metrics that they're pulling, or that they're requesting rather, they're kind of narrowly defined or they're lacking context, I try to, where I have opportunity to speak to the funders, is to say, hey, I realize you're trying to get this, but do you realize if you get this information, it's going to tell this story that's automatically going to make most universities, not just the Black ones, most universities will probably look bad in light of what you're saying here. And by the way, I don't know if you all know that most of the metrics by which we tend to be judging higher education, they really only work for fewer than 100 universities out of 5,000 plus. And so you can think about that. You're like, oh, huh, we really define higher ed and success based on what works well at the Ivies, the Ivy Plus, and flagship public. Oh, well, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense now, does it? And so if I have opportunities to speak with the funders, I try to have those conversations internally. As far as our team, I try to focus and say, hey, look, let's begin by engaging with the institution. Say, what are your strategic plan priorities? Because that's where the value lies. So I want to have that. Now, thankfully, it's not as if it's just Philip by himself saying, hey, strategic plan. And everyone else is like, why would you do that? our broader team understands that. So we're already aligned with that reality and saying, so our transformation process begins by, hey, let's engage you all to understand your strategic priorities. Mm-hmm. And also let's do a needs analysis. And to see how these things align, because that's where you're going to get the most lift, because the whole purpose of data is to inform and optimize decision-making. And it should be driving value. Yep. And because this is a nonprofit working with HBCUs, in my mind, it should first and foremost drive value and inform decisions for the institutions.
And on that point, Philip, just for our audience, give us some examples of what value would be in these contexts. And so as you're working with those historically Black colleges and universities, what is value in their minds and how do they measure that? So give us a few examples.
Oh, that's a huge thing. So there's a lot of value. So obviously there's the basic things. We want students to be enrolled. We want them to stay enrolled and we want them to graduate. Wonderful. And we want them to graduate and move on to be satisfactorily employed and paid. Wonderful. Those are certain things where there's value there. But there's also a value that's the value that most people talk about when they're talking about higher education. But then there's a value that often gets understated. Now, you two, I think, both went to Wheaton. You all both went to Wheaton?
Moody.
Just kidding. I was testing you. Wait, hey, you both passed the test.
Speaking of rivalries, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. You went to Wheaton and vandalized it. No, with pages of scripture. No, so there at Moody, rather, you... And that is at Moody Bible Institute. If they're judging Moody based on how much its alumni were paid, or how quickly this person was fully employed doing XYZ, or the number of Moody grads who are working at Fortune 500 institutions, you'd be like, oh, well, Moody's a
number's not looking good.
Yeah. So how do we define value for Moody? Well, we look at Moody. What do you exist to do? Do you memorize Moody's mission statement? Don't say, if you don't say it on the recording. but if you look at Moody's mission statement, it'll tell you what Moody values. If you look at Moody's strategic plan, hopefully they have a valuable, some people just come up with, you know, strategic plans just to make one, but we'll just assume Moody actually has one. That tells you what they value. Many times it's going to be producing some variation of thinking Christians who are actively participating, reflecting Christ well in society and everything they do, some version of that right there.
Sure.
So how well does Moody do that? How well is Moody equipping its graduates to be effective Christians in whatever their walk of life may be? And there are people who are paying, I don't know how much it costs to go there, but they're not going for free. So they're paying money to go there, which tells you they value what Moody values. Mm-hmm. Likewise with the HBCUs. You look at the mission. Largely speaking, I've worked at a Christian college and worked at HBCUs. I mean, working for HBCUs. And one thing that they have in common is that they both represent these smaller subgroups of people who don't see themselves represented in higher education. And not only do we not see ourselves represented, we actually see who and what we represent actually actively attacked in higher education. I spoke with some philosophy instructors who are just like, I can't tell people that I'm a Christian because I lose all credibility in this world here. Black folks, I mean, hey, people automatically assume we don't even belong in higher education. Like, the affirmative action conversation is stupid, y'all, because I don't know what side of it y'all are on. If we're on opposite sides, then, you know, I might be starting to fight, but I'm not trying to. But the reason why, I'll tell you why I say it's stupid. So it first started, I'm from California, born and raised. And so I was in high school when the California first banned affirmative action. And the conversation was always based on, oh, these underqualified Blacks and Latinos are taking our place in the UCs. And I first heard it and I was like, well, first of all, your mama. And then second of all, how would you even know that I'm underqualified? As a kid, as a 15-year-old, I didn't quite have all of the language to say to really articulate it well. But as I thought over time, I was able to get it. But the thing that's really crazy is that no one ever considers the possibility of a white person that doesn't deserve to be there. Right. The existence of an underqualified white person is like, nah, we all made it. But my whole point is, being Black, higher education has made it very, very clear that is not for us. So the value of HBCUs is not just having a space, but now how do you maintain your dignity and walk in this excellence that is inherent in putting your blackness? I'm going to say, I'm going to add that is inherent in how God made us, part because we're made in the image of God. How do we walk this out there? Now that's a part of it that's harder to measure.
Mm-hmm. That was my question. It's easy to measure salaries or Fortune 500 placements, but how do you measure those kind of results out of
and
the university?
And it's riddled with bias, as you're talking about here. You might measure it by the percentage of this ethnicity versus that ethnicity, but it is riddled with bias about what that ethnicity actually means, which isn't measured in a concrete way. So how do you deal with that, you know, presupposition that people bring to the table about race and ethnicity and how that ties to qualification? And then to Sawyer's point, how do you then provide the alternative solution of here's some concrete ways to measure that?
And that's the thing. People don't have patience for processes. That's why we have proxies. That was an unintentional alliteration. However, it's there. And we most of our measurements are proxies. It's proxies on proxies on proxies. Our measurements for salary, those aren't even good. When we look at ROI for colleges and universities and is based off of salary career day, that's not even good. People look at, oh, these folks got this job out of straight out of college. They're looking at the best source of data for that is going to be the NACE's First Destination Survey. It is a voluntary survey of alumni. So I don't know if you all are like me, you get stuff from the school alumni survey. It's typically through some third party, like, I don't know who you are, how'd you got my address, but leave me alone. And then if you get something, I'll be more inclined to respond to something that's straight from the school, perhaps. But alumni surveys, you don't get 100% of the alumni base participating. Mm-mm. And then it's self-reported. And then it's, you know, there's so many different things, but NACE is still the best that we have at this point. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're looking at private universities and people who are doing all kinds of things, which might not even be on, you know, IRS may never really know all these other things that someone is doing. And so when I was working at the Christian University, I was working at Biola University, and I was looking at some of the data from the NACE server. Once again, it's good once you understand those nuances and the gaps. Mm-hmm. But as I began to look at it, I saw certain things. I was like, oh, wait a minute, what's going on here? What's happening here? And as I looked into it, I was like, oh, this looks bad. But as I looked into it, I said, oh, this makes sense. When you understand the culture of the institution and the students and what they value, you look at it, you're like, they're actually very satisfied with their outcomes. And so part of the issue is that it is hard, but we tend to go, I have a job to do. And so at the end of the day, people want to see results. So if I say, hey, look, if someone says, hey, we want to know the value of this, and I go, well, you know, it's pretty difficult. We need to do a 20-year longitudinal study with full of qualitative data to answer the question that you asked today. It's like, well, that's not going to cut it. So sometimes there are some legitimate reasons why we're looking at these proxies, because to really be thorough, it would take a lot of time. Yep. And between now and then, so many things will have changed. 20 years ago, there wasn't even an iPhone. Were iPods even out 20 years ago? I don't know. I forget. But you seem like so much can change within 20 years, let alone 50, that you do need to have something with a shorter turnaround. But then some data just aren't available. Some things, like I said, are very qualitative. How do you measure spiritual growth? Like, give me every pastor in America wants that. I mean, well, some of them do. Some of them would rather not have that. But the get that out of here. You're going to make the rolls go lower. But you see, so some things are just difficult. And so there are some legitimate difficulties. So I don't want to make it seem like people are just lazy and greedy. But I think the legitimate things also tie together with impatience and just like, give me now results, 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 now. It creates this thing that we have. It's just difficult. Yeah. And it's hard to really find a good way forward. But I do know that big part of the way forward really involves knowing each other and knowing people. And that takes us back to difficult. One quote that I'll say, it's just like data problems are people problems. And that's, I get that from Harvard Strategic Data Project. And that's when they often say data problems or data issues are people issues. And we think that we could just solve it by this analysis or this tool. But really, the hardest work is dealing with the people to get the data together, to understand the data, the people that the data are talking about. It's wild.
A lot of data people are really comfortable in the quantitative side of analytics, where we're talking about numbers, dollar figures or test scores or whatever. You've been talking a lot about the qualitative side of that. And can you speak a little bit about, I guess, how much work do you do on both sides of that, quantitative and qualitative, and even some of the differences in how you approach analytics or decision-making with two different sorts of data types like that? Yeah, maybe how you start to think through comparing those and using those and leveraging those well.
Qualitative data don't get enough respect. They don't. Once again, probably going back to because it's harder. It's just like a lot. You look at it, it's like, oh, words, come on. And I want to say that it is so, like the two are, they play into each other. You know, so I've done a lot of survey analyses. I've done some things with focus groups and interviews, things of that nature. And so the survey itself is going to be, you're going to get some stuff, which are basically the analysis is going to be quantitative because you're going to be looking at assigning the number to each point in the Likert scale, whatever. But let's say you do your survey and then you're like, oh, these are some interesting results. The numbers don't tell me enough. I need to talk with you all to understand this. Okay, let's talk. Now we're having this qualitative part. Okay, that's really interesting. You know what? This thing came up. We need to do some research into this topic that came up here. And as you're doing that, there might be some more quantitative things that are coming up in your research. And also, it's a huge undertaking. And I think I like to partner with the researchers. I have certain things. I have research proclivities, but not necessarily research responsibilities. And so I like to stay really close to the researchers and say, hey, here's what's going on. So in some of the conversations that we've been having at my current role, people are asking me a lot of questions because I'm the one in front. Like, if you can make a cool dashboard, everyone wants to talk to you. And so, you know, so I'm in the front. As I look at, I'm hearing these questions. I'm like, you know what? I need to go ask this research team. So we have the team Frederick D. Patterson Research Institute. They're incredible researchers. They've done a depth of work on HBCUs and the value of HBCUs that you can look. They have something talking about the HBCU effect, punching above their weight. That's all their work. And if someone asks me a question about HBC, it's like, that's a good question. Hey, let me go ask this team over here. And the more I do that, I say, you know what? You guys should stop asking me this question. You should ask them this question. And so I'm starting just pointing people to them. And not because I'm trying to, you know, compete one way or the other, but I feel like it has to be in strong partnership. And so behind the scenes, I'm going to have conversations with them and say, how do we actually partner together to answer this question well? Because it doesn't need to, people aren't looking for quants. Well, people don't need quants or qual, they need answers.
Yeah.
And our answers need to be thorough and holistic. So if I can engage with this team well and say, well, from this angle and this angle, I'm informing what they're saying and they're informing what I'm saying. And then we come together and say, here is a bigger picture. I feel like that's really the best way to do it. It's rare that you have an individual who is going deep on all the quantitative and deep on, you know, doing a whole lot of research just because the research can be so intensive.
So the end result of that is people want answers. What do those answers look like from a decision-making standpoint? So you want people to do things with this data. What does data that drives decision-making look like?
Let me ask for clarification. Do you mean like what types of data elements? Or are you talking about data products and deliverables? Or what do you mean?
Yeah. How do you communicate with data, or how do you do the research in a way that you can deliver something that will drive action or drive somebody, inform somebody to be able to make a decision? As opposed to maybe we present a dashboard of information. We present a report with lots of information. What does it look like to have a decision-making lens when you're either doing the analysis or when you are communicating that analysis?
Okay, yeah. So I think the first part is just to just as you're doing it, think this is not about my analysis. It's about what is the research question? What is the decision that needs to be made? And just really have that focus. And even above that, what are the higher strategic priorities that are in place? I have recently been doing a presentation first with the Alabama Association for Institutional Research. Then I did it with the National Association for Institutional Research. And it was just called Beyond Waffle House, shifting from transactional data providers to strategic partners. And in it, I highlight four personas that reflect they reflect paradigms that are ultimately limiting the value of data teams. One is the Waffle House, which is basically the ad hoc champion, high volume ad hoc stuff. Second is the vending machine. Now, the vending machine is trash, just to call it out what it is. It's just, you get a vending machine because you don't want to deal with people. And when the vending machine gets on your nerves, what do? You punch it, you hit it, you shake it. It's like, no respect, give me what I want right now. And you treat it poorly. That doesn't provide much value at all. But then there's the glorified Alexa. You know, that's like the underutilized sophistication, capacity to take us to the, like, we've had AI in our homes for years and we're asking it fart jokes. and then there's the butler, you know, the invisible workhorse. Now, the butler is interesting because I think that the butler kind of really gets to what we want from all four of these. It's kind of like we really want the butler. When you think about a butler, what do you get a butler for? You get a butler to do all the things that you really don't want to do. Like, no one hires a butler and says, I want you to do the most important and enjoyable things in my life. You're just like, here's all the things that I don't want to do, don't have time to do. Typically, in an organization, the person who says, I'm not a data person, and the person who says, I don't have time to do the data, they just, like, the solution is the data butler. And so they give all the stuff to the data butler, which is fine because sometimes you're just at that place and you need that. And you just absolutely do. Yep. And there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is, can you imagine? I don't know if either of you two have butlers. I mean, you don't seem like butler haver.
Nope.
Sawyer, you got a butler?
No, no butler in this house.
You got a livery, black tie affairs, you know?
I'm working on my kids to see if they can fill some of that role. But no,
yeah, exactly, really exactly, out. Exactly. You need a butler for those butlers.
Yeah.
But like, so the, if you imagine having a butler to help with all the things around the house, and then you sit back and you realize this butler is really talented. They could do so much more. Sure, the part of you that loves people is going to be like, I really want to encourage them to leave and go do better things with their lives. But the part of you that hired them is going to say, no, I need you to stay. I don't want you. People will not be willing to get rid of having a butler. Once you have a butler, you want to keep that butler. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the data butler. So in other words, the very inertia that led to the need for a data butler will lead to that butler never transcending that state. The ideal scenario, the ideal persona is the navigator, like not like GPS, but the crew member. And so that navigator is what helps to guide you to your destination. It helps identify obstacles, threats, all these things along the way. The navigator does not control the vessel, but the navigator partners with the pilot to get it. The navigator has a strong understanding of the mission objectives. The navigator has learned the crew and the pilot or the captain. And so they know, okay, here's how to and how not to talk. Here's what they value. And sometimes here's when I just need to stand firm and push on these things. Here's where I need to relent because it's a partnership. You see, the navigator is a strategic partner. Those first four, they were all transactional and reactive. The navigator, it is strategic and it is proactive. And so you have to be proactive. Going back to what I said before, so much of this is relational. These are people issues. And that's really, when you get down to the decision-making, you can't skip past the people part. And I think many times those of us who are the analysts and the data scientists, we skip past that, which is why there's that stat that says up to the highest I saw was 87% of data science initiatives failed to produce any ROI.
I love those personas. I think that's really powerful. And it provides more of that humanness to what it means to be a technical person. And, you know, we've all heard the stereotypes of, oh, well, we put the tech people in the closet because they're not good with people. But data, more than any other, I think, position within tech, is calling tech people to a higher position of, you need those people skills. You need the soft skills to be able to relate. And Philip, you shared with us earlier before we started recording that you're a preacher, that you're a communicator, and that there's some real parallels between what you do to prepare a message to communicate and the same thing you would do to prepare, say, a presentation on a dashboard or data. Tell us more about those parallels that you've seen between those two things.
Yeah, one of my colleagues called me the daywalker, like Blade Wesley Snipes. And so, because it's like being able to walk in both worlds. I'm gonna say that's a grace from God. While I was studying computer engineering, people were like, "You sure you're an engineer? Because you like people too much." And I was like, I think that's a compliment. I think,
but you just have a really big closet, and that's really everyone can fit in there with you.
Yeah, there's room for everyone in my closet. Yeah. So basically, when you're preparing a sermon, you know, three general steps: observation, interpretation, application. If you want to make it simple. And you're observing all these things, not just in the text, but the context, you know, the historical, literary, cultural context. You're reading some, like the chapter before and after. You might be reading some of the other works. You're reading some commentaries, all these different things. You might be getting some Hebrew or Greek if you're into that sort of thing. I really am. Oh, my goodness. I like it. But you want to make sure that you're following certain processes. Your methodology is on point. There's just some key hermeneutical methods that you want to employ to make sure that you're not messing things up. I love Haddon Robinson had a whole article talking about the heresy of application. And you're just going straight from, hey, here's this to, bam, here's what. No, you got to go through the process. However, the process of all of that exegetical, hermeneutical processing is not an end into itself. No one cares. No one wants to see all that. You'll put everyone to sleep and they'll turn to sawdust. What you want to do is, like, the whole point of that is to communicate it. And some of us, some of us will sit back and they have all this stuff. Only the other scholars want to see the scholarly work. And there is a place for that, to be sure. But that's not really the primary focus. Even the scholars who are doing the scholarly work together, there has to be a place besides just scholarly discussions. Otherwise, this is pointless. There has to be a spiritual and lived out impact. But even then, the next step between there is communicating it from the scholarly to, you know, like it typically we'll say in the sermon. But for many people, they stop there and they say the whole point is to create this wonderful, crafty sermon. And here's this bomb sermon with all these things. And it's just like, yeah, I could connect with this and this and this. And, you know, I got to, you know, Kendrick Lamar was hot this year. So I'm going to drop in some, they not like us. We talk about holiness, baby. And so we have a great opportunity to tie it all together, all this cultural relevance. Oh, wow, that's so cool. And then, but that's not really the end point. The end goal is to communicate it, not so that I could get the glory, not so I could be big, but so that people who hear it, the hearers, they receive it, they can understand it, and they'll be faced with a decision. What do I do with this information that's been given to me? And do I choose how does it affect my daily decision? Do I choose to abide by it or not? You, in my preaching, I realize everybody has a decision. I want to inform the decision as much. No, I'm saying inform, not drive, because that's, you know, in church culture, that's how you to be, that's a element of unhealthy cultures, we'll say sinful cultures, where we're trying to force behavior. And because I'm doing it by now, that's not the same thing on the data side, but that was like a quick church hurt thing. We're not trying to force behavior, but we do want to inform decisions. We want to inform behavior. Same thing with data. No, we're not taking all these data and looking at them so that people can look at all these incredible, fascinating statistical methodologies. No, the scholars need to see that, sure. And it's important. It has its place. But that's not the whole point. And I think that's part of the reason why many of these initiatives fail, because people are doing things based off of some sort of intellectual curiosity, but it's not actually tied to decisions that need to be made. There's some people that they get it and they go, hey, look, I create these awesome dashboards. I made these great deliverables. And they think like that's the end goal. No, it's not. The end goal is not your dashboard or deliverable. That's why people are saying dashboards are dead. Dashboards aren't dead. Dashboards, they're not dead. They're just overused. Yeah. And people are stopping there. The whole point is, how do I inform these decisions? And by the way, a great preacher is going to be a great pastor. What I mean by that is you understand the people to whom you're communicating. Mm-hmm. You are part of the community in which you're communicating. You are living it with them. And so now, because you've taken time to understand your audience or your stakeholders, now when it comes to going from these things, even the nerdiest, so like I've seen some of the nerdiest people in the world who have zero like cultural similarities to their audience, because they've taken time to understand and actually to understand and learn the people, they've been able to communicate things in a way that had the greatest impact. Because they understood and cared for the people, and they understood, here's what you all are wrestling with. So how do I do the biggest stretch is to take all of this information and tie it to what people are wrestling with, both in data and in sermon preparation, even Bible study.
That's like that navigator role of, I am looking out, I'm seeing the terrain. I realize where the curves are, where the bumps are, where the trouble is and where the smooth path is, and I am navigating us to a destination, and like the navigator role is alongside on the journey, looking and navigating it with the people on the ship or the plane or whatever we're navigating.
Yeah. Can you imagine a navigator who gets so annoyed when the captain doesn't listen and they said, just move, I'll take over. It's like, we call that mutiny, my friends.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Like sometimes us in data teams, we feel that way. But and sometimes in churches, I'm sure people feel that way. But it's there's a little bit of a difference, though, because in churches, typically the preacher has some sort of authority, whereas in our organizations, the data team typically doesn't have that authority. Sure. And so that's where the metaphor begins to break down, like I said. But it's still an interesting thing to even realize within ourselves, though.
Yeah, I love that you brought up the fact that there's a lot that goes behind research, studying this, mining the data, trying to figure out the mess of it all, going through that exegetical process before you communicate the conclusions. And we have to be able to put that upfront time into building that conclusion. And I had a professor who said, now in the context of preparing for a sermon, but it was, you know, people don't want to see that. It's like your underwear. You need it to gird your loins, but don't go showing it to nobody. So had to share that.
I appreciate that. That's hilarious. I mean, yeah, really, if you think about when I don't really need to see every grain that's been put into my bowl of cereal. I just want my cereal made. And I want to, and the thing is, I want to trust that you've done a good job. Now that the role, what I do want to know is that you've taken the care to select quality ingredients to take. Yeah. I know that I can trust you to not be sweating all over my food. And, you know, not, you know, like you take care of what you're doing and you handle things. You handle things with care when you give it to me with care. I want to trust your preparation, but I don't need to know everything that's in it. Your preparation is important, but not right here.
Philip, you've talked about just like the large source of challenges and complex problems that there are to solve with your work at UNCF and with HBCUs. What's kind of the vision, or what are you hoping for over the next 12, 18 months? Like, what's the next step for you? Where are you headed with knowledge management and capacity building? What's your vision for kind of the direction you're headed and what you're hoping for?
Yeah, one of the things what I'm excited about doing is, so I have built a community of practice, the HBCU Data Advisory Group. And so that's the very thing I was saying. Many times we tend to start with intermediaries and funders, and we get together in rooms and have great ideas. We're really excited and get the contract signed. And we go to the institutions and say, hey, look, we got this great deal. You want to get on board? Come on, there's money involved. And I mean, and it's not like a UNCF thing. That's just like the nonprofit thing. And so what I'm trying to say is, you know, let's do this differently. Let me go and engage these stakeholders and say, let me understand you on your own terms. Let me understand your needs on your own terms. At the same time, I'm also, because I understand these are data teams, it's typically people from institutional research and effectiveness. In higher ed, that will be your institutional researches and or effectiveness would be your core data team that's looking at most centralized look at data for understanding things about the university. So because these are data folks, I also have to realize, hey, look, you guys are great at this part. But how do I stretch you all to be thinking as, don't just deliver data, deliver value. And so there's a stretch for the data teams there, but there's also a part, say, now that let's understand this, how do we make sure it's tied to that value? And then, so my direct report, part of her projects is actually to go there, just do this gap analysis and understand some solutions. And then we want to engage funders. We have some funders that I'm excited about and working with who are also excited about this whole process. They were just like, you know what, this would be a great way for us to consider just engaging nonprofits as a whole and say, let's start with the stakeholders. Let's understand things from their perspective. Let's co-create solutions with them. So now we're not spending so much time and effort trying to get folks to buy in for something that was made talking about them, but not with them. So I'm really excited about that and growing that. I'm excited about developing partnerships to increase that more. I'm really excited about opportunities to partner with the FDPRI, the Frederick D. Patterson Research Institute that I mentioned earlier, to talk about, hey, how do we actually strengthen this community of practice so that we are able to better build people's capacity just in terms of networking opportunities, skilled upskilling opportunities, anything like that. I there's so many opportunities that could come just from engaging this community of practice and scaling, and in that to scale capacity building across several HBCUs. Right now, we already have over, I think I've had over 50, 60 something individuals from over 40 institutions. There's 101 HBCUs nationwide. So that's a pretty good reach. And so just having that level of influence and just really solidifying and growing that, there's huge opportunities with that. Not, once again, not for me, not so that I can, you know, build my platform, but to actually help the institutions build up their capacity at the levels where they need it. And real quick, one reason why that's important, almost all the funders are requesting data. And I've often said to them, you all are demanding outputs, but you have not invested in the inputs. That makes zero sense.
Yep.
And so let's now build, if you were to invest in these inputs, especially on the data side, I had a conversation with one institution recently, and the president was saying, well, yeah, here's these things on all these other levels of advising, advancement, of course scheduling and registration, enrollment. Those are the core things. That's like the biceps and the chest and everything. But this person recognized that the data, that's leg day. And this president, she kept saying, yeah, but we need this, but we just don't have the data. Once we get the data, we can do better with this. If we had the data, it could do this. Or if the data were more aligned and integrated, we could do this. She understood that the data are leg day. And what I'm trying to get is just everyone to understand this is leg day. Now, the data, it's not the whole thing. Some people think data is everything. No, this is leg day. And I want the funders, hey, let's get these things. But I feel like having this opportunities to build a coalition around data as leg day, because then we realize there is no transformation without data.
My workouts are never going to be the same now.
Philip, why have you chosen to invest your careers, your skills, your talent as a communicator? Why are you doing it in data and in higher education specifically? What landed you here and why have you chosen to stay here?
Man, okay, so short story. I'm getting ready to graduate from Georgia Tech. I'm at a NSBE conference. That's the National Society of Black Engineers. And a couple of things happened. But one was I was at a session. They were talking about the digital divide. This is over 20 years ago. And they were saying, which is crazy because we're still talking about the digital divide. And they were just talking about certain realities that I knew were true. They were saying like a lot of black schools, you may have one computer for every like 100 or 200 students, where a lot of the white schools, particularly the white schools that are in more affluent neighborhoods, you might have one computer per every 10 students. And so the data might show that there's computers at the school, but you're not really showing how much things are accessible to the students. And I chose computer engineering on accident. I saw my uncle go to work with some flip-flops, shorts, basketball shorts, and a tank top. And I knew back in the 90s, he was getting paid a good amount of money. And I said, he doesn't have to wear a suit. My parents told me you have to wear a suit if you want to make good money. What does he do? Well, I know he works with computers. He works with computers, and the word engineering is in his title. I'll do that, I guess. Now, just that little bit of exposure changed my life. And I just still didn't even understand what an engineer was. So I said, you know what? I'm getting ready to graduate from Georgia Tech. I'm graduating from the best engineering school in the country. Ha, sorry, not sorry, everybody else. I said the best. like the best engineering school in the country. And I really just thinking about what they said. One thing they said is like, imagine if there will be no Michael Jordan if no one ever showed him a basketball. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about how many other Michael Jordans there were of engineering that never really saw it or saw themselves in it. So I say, you know what? I'm going to go teach high school. And I'll have enough friends who are still engineers. I can bridge that gap there. But I don't have enough friends who are teachers. So I went to go teach high school. I did that for a couple of years. And then I had already been preaching. I started preaching right before I graduated from college. And then I was like, also wanted to go to seminary. So then I went back to the West Coast to Talbot School of Theology at Biola for seminary. And while I was there, I was like, man, I need a job to support my habit of school. And also / I want to get married. So I started working at the university. And so I was working there in advancement fundraising as a project researcher. So once again, data. And I was actually getting ready to go back to robotics. And the opportunity came. I was literally getting ready to go, and Laura was like, "Philip, pause, just wait." So I was like, "All right, I'm gonna wait, but this waiting stuff is dumb, God. I know it's what you tell us to do, but this is dumb." And I waited, And then someone came up talking about this thing. Said, hey, you know what? I got a thing. Maybe a good opportunity for you. You can really utilize your tech education. I'm like, everybody says that. Like, they're always like, this will be a good thing, a great Georgia Tech thing. And they're like, okay, what is it? I look, I get excited. It's like, man, can you do some if in Excel? I'm like, oh, you don't go to Georgia Tech to do some ifs, my friend. But it's hard to say that because you sound really cocky. You know what I mean? But it's just like, fine. So then I started being about, it was in strategic planning. And it was a whole new role. And I was like, whoa, this is incredible. I love it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I could see myself doing this for the rest of my career. And that's really where it all started, being able to be at the center of strategic decision making, strategic conversations. That was my navigator role. Every single one of those four, those five personas I mentioned, the four bad ones and a navigator, every single one of those, I've been in roles. They all came from experience, corroborated with other folks within the field nationally. Right. But it was very much experience driven. And so just being in that, realizing how much I was able to be a part of a lot of important conversations and make a huge impact. And even going back to fulfill that thing that happened at Nesby, how I can help decision makers on this side understand and make decisions that could really impact the students as they're coming in. That was really the genesis of it, and it's just been growing ever since then.
And expanding the reach across now 50 plus HBCUs, and like your yeah. opportunity to shape data strategy and data thoughtfulness and literacy is being able to touch larger and larger groups of people and larger institutions. So
now, Philip, because you're a higher education guy, you got to get this one. All right. So did the professor take his class onto the airplane?
Why?
Because he wanted them to get a higher education.
I was going to say that, but I was like, it's too obvious. That can't be it.
Nope. All of Sarah's jokes are terrible.
It was right there.
Yeah. Right there. I want someone to get it once. Come on.
Like, I just knew it was it was the first thing in my brain. I was like, no, he can't. He's not going to go for that one. He's not. He's reaching for something. There's something never, beyond this.
I was reaching never for something higher. It's true.
Never overestimate Troy. Yeah. Okay. So, yep.
I appreciate you, sir. I appreciate your commitment to this. Please keep it up.
Philip Wallace, the flawless. This has been wonderful. thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to meet you. This is the first time we've gotten to really connect. It was joy to hear your story, hear about the work you're doing, and yeah, just have your insights from the higher education world. So love it. If people want to reach out to you or connect with you, hear more about your work or UNCF, where's a good place to connect with you online?
The best way is LinkedIn for me. Yeah, sure. I've kind of cut myself off from most other social media. So LinkedIn would be the best way. And if you email me to my work email address and I don't know you, it's going to be deleted. I have too much. I'm just like, no, I got to prioritize. What is this? So LinkedIn will be the best way to get it.
Pleasure. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. And listeners, thanks for joining us on this episode of Making Data Matter. Have a great day, everybody.